Hi, welcome to New Books in Politics. I'm your host, Jeff Bloodworth. Barack Obama has given his fifth State of the Union address. And if you're a political junkie like me, you of course stayed up and watched it. And if you're a super duper political junkie, you even watched the Republicans reply to the State of the Union. Now, I don't know if you're a super-duper-duper political junkie, but you would have to have been to have actually watched the other reply to the State of the Union address, and that was delivered by Rand Paul. Now, what is most fascinating to me in 2013 is really not about the Democratic Party. It's really about the Republican Party and the political right, because the Republicans had two replies to the State of the Union address, and I think it says a lot about the disarray and the infighting that's going on within the Republican Party. And that's why this week, in sort of honor of the State of the Union address, and to put it in a little bit of historical context, I interviewed Kevin Mattson, who's written a really fine book called Just Plain Dick: Richard Nixon's Checker Speech and the Rocking Socking Election of 1952. This is put out by Bloomsbury Press. It came out just last year. It's written with verve, with humor, and Mattson has his own very inventive sort of style of writing. And he actually makes Richard Nixon interesting again. And for us, at least, in understanding the State of the Union address and understanding the Republicans too replies. What Mattson has done is he's putting the Tea Party and the modern new right into historical context. And what he's arguing is that Richard Nixon's Checker speech is kind of the prototype of the first speech of the new right and what we call the Tea Party. And what I think is especially correct about this book is that he doesn't fall into this, the idea that there's a dichotomy between the establishment modern, the establishment moderate Republican Party and the Tea Party. You know, because Nixon was both at the same time a part of the establishment, and it is seen especially by the time he became president as, part of the Eisenhower wing. But he always had a foot in the other side, in the more conservative and aggressive side of the Republican Party. And so what Mattson argues is that the Checker speech is really what's kind of established a template for the new right and what we call the Tea Party today. And so this is a book, if you want to understand what's going on inside the Republican Party, I think you really need to read this book, and because I think it helps get rid of this sort of false dichotomy that is sort of there's the establishment Republicans and there is the Tea Party. Yes, they are different wings of the Republican Party, but they also have very common roots. So listen to the interview, buy the book, read it, tell your friends, and I hope you enjoy it. Hey, Kevin Mattson, welcome to New Books in Politics. How are you doing?
Good to be with you. How are you doing?
Doing well. On today's show, we have Kevin Mattson, and we're going to talk about his book, Just Plain Dick, Richard Nixon's Checker Speech and the Rocking Socking Election of 1952. Kevin, why don't you start off by telling the listeners just a little bit about you, education, your biography, that sort of thing?
Sure. I was born in the Washington, D.C. area in 1966. It was an easy place for me to get engaged in politics, which I did at a pretty young age, becoming a young political activist in that area. I eventually decided that I wanted to get a better handle on history and politics, so I started to start my career as an undergraduate at the New School for Social Research, and then did a PhD at the University of Rochester, and got that in 1994. From that point, I helped to run a nonprofit center that worked on issues of democratic participation, and then wound up getting a teaching position at Ohio University in 2001, and have been here since. And most of the teaching and writing that I do deals with the kind of intersection between politics and ideas in America's past.
So would you say, you grew up in D.C. and sort of the height of the age of Reagan?
Yeah. Yeah, I was there in the 1980s, and it was was the person who organized counter inaugural protest in 1984. In fact, that's where, in many ways, I cut my teeth in politics. And I also learned how to write. I always point this out to people, but I learned how to write by putting together newspapers and fanzines. I was also connected to the DC punk rock scene of the 1980s, which also has some claims to fame, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, from the title of this book, especially, you know, I mean, I can tell in your writing style throughout the narrative, but especially how you open, you know, in your introduction, I mean, you have a distinctive style, right? That's kind of, you know, like, it seems to me it's just distinctive. I mean, do you want to talk about, like, you know, let's start with the title. I mean, there's a certain kind of, I don't know, a little bit sort of, would you call it Gen X cynicism or in your face kind of humor?
It could be, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, it could be. Of course, the title is actually, there's a reference to it, which is that this is actually, and it's kind of a fascinating one, because this is one of the first political speeches to ever get covered in the entertainment industry press.
Yeah.
So Variety reviews it and compares it to the soap operas of the day and age, which often had the front running line of just plain Sal, or whatever the name of the central character was.
Yeah.
And so they came up with just plain Dick because they thought that they were watching a kind of soap opera performance on the part of this guy running for the vice presidency. I love the title because I also thought it kind of gave you the sense, not just of, you know, I think probably captures some people's attention just by the title, but it's also, it gives you the sense that this is a guy trying to paint himself as a populist. Here's a guy who's just been exposed as taking money from, you know, the oil industry, bankers, real estate people. And yet what he does is he comes off as a common, ordinary, average man of the people. And so he becomes just plain Dick. And that, so I wanted the title to kind of reflect, you know, a title that, that maybe captured people's eyes, but also, represented what was in the book, which is a treatment about this guy. And I wanted to get inside his mindset as best as I possibly could. And that's always there's dangers with that, because you can always project your own kind of feelings and sentiments onto actors from the past, and that can get you into troubled waters. But, you know, I wanted to paint a picture of this guy, and to paint him as what he was, which was a, you know, a young person on the cusp of potentially making or breaking his entire political career, and give you a sense of the sort of, you know, sweaty, scared attitude that he brought to the crisis that prompts the speech.
Yeah, no, you know, when I first saw this book, my first thought was, why a book about, you know, Richard Nixon? And then I read the book, and then I was, you know, it really is a great read. And then, you know, knowing your other work, I'm like, oh, well, now it totally, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, do you want to just talk kind of broadly, what is the speech? You kind of alluded to that, but, you know, talking about how the speech, this sort of fake populism of the right.
Yeah. That's one of the key things that, you know, for our contemporary political atmosphere, less so in the last presidential election, but certainly throughout the 2000s as we've lived through them, there's been that sort of ability that the right has used to see itself in opposition to elites, which are characterized not by people who necessarily have a lot of money or a lot of property, but who might be educated, who might be snobbish, and so forth and so on. For Richard Nixon, that was, if you were Ivy League educated and East Coast, you were pretty much a member of the American elite, even if you didn't necessarily have a lot of money to go along with that. But so he, you know, what he's doing in this speech, again, the original crisis that he has to address is that he's been seen taking a building a fund that's been contributed to by California businessmen that are in oil and banking and real estate to give him more money that he can use to campaign with. And you know, people felt that he wasn't upfront about the existence of this.
Mm-hmm.
It gets exposed in a liberal magazine, in a liberal newspaper. And that's, of course, one thing, because for Nixon, that means that this is kind of this could be a potential conspiracy on the part of liberal elites within the mass media. And he always hated the media. The hatred of the media goes all the way back to 1952 and even, I think, earlier than that. And so he's trying to explain himself on national television. And he, in process, creates the most highly watched speech in history up to that point in time because of TV. And in the process of making the speech, his whole goal is to paint himself as an ordinary average Joe. And that's again why that feeling of just plain dick comes right out of the speech. So my interest is not just in the speech, but in the ways in which, you know, someone again who's clearly kind of palling around with fairly wealthy businessmen, mm-hmm. suddenly can paint himself as a radical populist, as a true man of the people.
Yeah, and so I mean, you start off your book, you know, it's in italics. We start off the book inside kind of Nixon's head, and sort of, you know, trying to understand, I guess, the mindset he has as he's approaching to write and then deliver a speech that's going to decide the rest of his political career. And I never really thought about this speech as sort of like the template or the speech of sort of the modern right. I mean,
I think that's right. I mean, I think that there is, I mean, of course you can go to other places and find things, but I really think as far as like a high profile event, a high profile guy like Nixon, this mm-hmm. is where you're seeing the template of right-wing populism, of this sort of aggressive attack on elites, this sort of, you know, the victimization that is so prevalent on the right, especially the victimization because of the, you know, the mass media's out to get you. I think some of the kind of paranoia and conspiracy thinking that I think is pretty evident on the right today. You can see it in Nixon. I one of the things that I discovered, I was talking to another person about the book the other day, and said, what was the most interesting thing you discovered? And one of the more interesting things I discovered was a speech that Nixon made during the campaign, in which he's on the West Coast, and he makes the allegation that unless Dwight Eisenhower is elected president, and of course him as mm-hmm. vice president, that there would be an imminent possibility of an invasion of the Soviet Union that would enter on the West Coast of the United States.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I realized that, you know, it was amazing to hear that sort of language, and that sort of, and I mean, the notion that the Soviet tanks were kind of being juiced up and ready to go. That sort of paranoia and conspiracy, and talking about a kind of dark, sinister world out there that we need a strong man to fight back against. All that stuff is really, I think, you know, very evident still today on the right end of the spectrum. Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got to admit, I've in the afternoons, I tune into Glenn Beck just want to check in. Oh yeah, I about 10-15 minutes worth on my drive home.
That's about as much as you can.
I can't take him seriously. Rush Limbaugh might make me, like, you know, wreck the car. Glenn Beck is just sort of humorous, but it's the same apocalyptic rhetoric, you know, and that's what's interesting, because,
right.
you know, because it made me think about this in a different way, because. And I think you're right. You don't call it the Eisenhower era, the 1950s. You say it's the Nixon era. Why is it the Nixon era?
Well, because, you know, I mean, I've always thought that's usually what is used to describe the 1950s is the Eisenhower era. I think actually Richard Nixon, and I think the speech makes this really evident, is the one who's really speaking to the type of person who's becoming more prevalent during the 1950s. And that's the kind of, white collar, person living in the suburb who's increasingly interested in purchasing, you know, the consumer items that we understand the 1950s to be about offering more of. And I think that Nixon is kind of speaking and can connect to those people in a way that an older general and hero really wasn't as able to connect to, that he couldn't speak to those people. Now, you know, of course, the Eisenhower presidency is you know, if you're, I think you can still call it the Eisenhower years. because his presidency defined so much of it. But in terms of the feeling in the political culture, I think Nixon is tapped into something much more than Eisenhower ever was. One of the things that's, I think, very clear to me about the way that Nixon kind of outshines Eisenhower during the 1952 campaign is that in some ways, Nixon is the sort of guy that a person who's working at a corporation who might have been kind of stiff-armed by his boss for a raise or something like that, Nixon gets into that, like he can feel that sort of resentment. And I think that's the more average American experience than, you know, a highly decorated wartime hero.
Absolutely.
I think Nixon is part of that feeling of that time.
So, I mean, you talk about, like, this is the story about the everyman. And, you know, and so Nixon is able to tap into the quote unquote every man or every woman. And it's sort of a, and I've thought about this too. I mean, you know, somehow or another, you know, after, you know, what, 20 years out of power, the Republicans, you know, Eisenhower's a war hero. It's sort of a given that he's going to win and defeat Stevenson. But in 1960, Nixon on his own, you know, not only nearly wins, right? I mean, he wins several kind of key border states. And
that's right.
I've always wondered, like, you know, like you already are seeing kind of Nixon able to building a coalition. Kind of it's, you know, it's presaging what becomes kind of the Reagan era. Is there anything to that?
I think there is. I mean, I think that the Republican Party in 1952 split divided in numerous different ways. I think that the sort of populist, at least projecting a populist image of campaigning the way Nixon campaigned in 1952.
Hello, Kevin.
There's other wings. I mean, there's, you know, there's the Dewey wing, and those are guys who are very uncomfortable with the populist stuff. They're very uncomfortable with the, you know, hyper aggressive Cold War stuff. They're really not comfortable at all. And so there's these battles within the Republican Party. I think Nixon understands that for the Republicans to be successful, they have to have a kind of populist tinge, get out of the whole notion of we're a bunch of wealthy East Coast guys, which was, I think, the perception of them. The fact that he came from the West already showed that, you know, his identity was bound to something that lay outside of the kind of East Coast elites, which I think, again, you know, someone like a Dewey was much closer to. And I think that, you know, what Nixon is doing in 1952 by building that kind of that sort of popular mobilization for the Republican Party that had been out for quite some time, as you point out, is similar to what he does in 1960. I think it's very similar to what he does, what he eventually gets, right? I mean, the dream that he gets is really 1972, when he just did, you know, he trounces. And that's the place where, I mean, you can still hear the sort of populism. You can hear the sort of, you know, all that stuff that you heard 20 years ago in 1952, you hear kind of amped up again. I think he's very conscious. I think he's very conscious, knowledgeable about some of what he's doing. Some of it, I think, is just, I mean, some of it is probably also, you know, dumb luck to a certain extent. But I think that you know, this is a guy who's very in tune with, I would say, not necessarily politics, but certainly in tune with what it takes to campaign as a Republican and to win, and what you have to do that. And some of that is saying you got to get down and dirty, and you got to run a rocking socking sort of campaign. You're not going to get it if you're you know, kind of too soft on your opposition. So the attack on Stevenson too is so central to the book, and it's about, you know, how, I mean, they're not only, Nixon doesn't only want to, you know, criticize Stevenson. He wants to pillory Stevenson. He wants to make Stevenson appear as if he's kind of like out of the mainstream. And it's an amazing job. It picks up on the fact that Stevenson's divorced. His wife is saying that she's going to vote Republican in 1952. What could that be about? Insinuations of homosexuality. He's an intellectual. He's an egghead. All those types of depictions, I think, are important for the way that Republicans, and especially the right element in the Republican Party, has successfully run campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Gingrich model that – well, it's the Nixon model, I guess, that Gingrich brings to the House in the 1980s. Yeah. We're not going to just defeat you. We're going to destroy you.
That's right. Thinking of politics as warfare.
Your entire credibility. So this is the thing I've always struggled with Nixon. Is he an establishment moderate Republican, or is he a right wing? Is he a conservative?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. My sense of it is that he governed. He tended to govern during his presidency domestically as a moderate. He campaigned as a hard right Betsy populist.
Yeah.
And I think he thought about ways to keep those two different worlds kind of separate from one another.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, he also, I mean, you know, what certainly stay, you know, there's that difference within him. But I think what one of the things that he's consistent on is the sort of paranoia about being attacked and never to be weak-kneed in terms of any political opposition he might come to face with. And I think you see that clearly defined for him in the Checkers moment. And then, you know, you see that playing itself out, you know, after he wins his second term as president and the discovery of the enemies list and the whole, you know, the rat fucking things that he's doing in 1972, all those horrible, you know, strategies that he's employing. Those are all things that I think, you know, he in some ways knew he had to do already by 1952. How
yeah.
you govern once you win power.
Yeah.
I think he's still a little bit more moderate in many
yeah.
ways.
And so, you know,
in 1952, he was seen as especially on foreign policy issues.
Yeah.
And on the hunt for, you know, lingering communists in the United States, he was seen as hard right.
Yeah.
He was seen much more and he was much more seen as a pal of Joseph McCarthy. And that's something that made Eisenhower very, very uncomfortable with
him. Yeah. And then it sort of once in power, especially in 68, he had become kind of a figure of the establishment. And then,
yeah.
of course, the new right can't stand him, or at least they don't like his foreign policy. And then, well, of course, they hate him after Watergate. I mean, this is just it made
they already hate him when he tries to run for governor, too. You know, I mean, that's
oh,
that,
yeah, that's
that
right.
Out, yeah. So, I mean, he's not made, you know, his friendships. I think he's always seen as someone who's so slippery.
Yeah.
Right. So that even if he pals around with a Joseph McCarthy in 1952, you know, I think McCarthy's, you know, clearly an ally with him.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever makes people feel that he's solidly in their camp. That's one of the things that the campaign of 52 shows is that he, in the beginning of the book, is playing all of his cards. He's not coming out clearly and saying we should get, you know, Eisenhower should be our choice. He's kind of like hiding and cloaking what it is that he believes.
Yeah.
And I think it's that element of distrust that goes along with the sort of paranoia of him that makes people not always comfortable with him. I've never found it's remarkable that, you know, it's Richard Nixon who wins such a landslide in 1972. Here's a guy who's just, you know, I don't think, how should I put this kindly? I don't think people really love him, you know, as a person and as a candidate. But
yeah.
he's capable of winning in that way. It's remarkable.
It really is. I mean, who loved Nixon? I mean, you know,
not himself either. Yeah, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, not even himself.
Yeah. I mean, it's and so on one hand, and I'm just thinking about Nixon as a figure of the Republican establishment. But also at the same time, the Republican establishment is giving birth to the new right, or at least the rhetoric of the new right. I mean, can we see this as also like, you know, how the Republic? I mean, yes, there are moderate Republicans, but at the end of the day, can we see Nixon as sort of a Republican establishment that really isn't separate from the new right, even though there's an attempt to, you know, Mitt Romney? We kind of get the sense that Mitt Romney was at his heart a moderate, but this is somebody who the Republican establishment is the new right at the same time. Do you know? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think we've drawn that line and made that distinction a little bit stronger than it should be between establishment and new right. And I think that the question is when can you see that line is not as firm as some people might think about it.
Yeah.
Campaigning. I mean, you know, don't forget, like Mitt Romney, Mr. Moderate, was campaigning as a hard right guy.
Yeah.
Conservative. You know, certainly when he was in the primary, right?
Yeah.
And then had a hard time doing the Etch-a-Sketch thing and trying to drive back to the center. But, you know, I think the notion that those two entities, the establishment wing and the, you know, new and harder right wing, are, you know, in complete and absolute opposition. I don't think that's true. I think that moderate Republicans will consistently use hard right tactics, especially when it comes to trying to run a successful campaign.
Yeah. So this sort of dichotomy of the, oh, it's the Tea Party and everybody else. It's like, no. The Tea Party is the Republican Party.
That's exactly right.
We just gave it
a new name.
That's
exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that, you know, the biggest wake up call for the Republicans is that, you know, they're, I think, coming face to face with the fact that it's not just this is some crazy wing. This is you. You know, I mean, this is it. And
yeah.
I think that notion of making a clean distinction is flat out wrong.
Yeah, I mean, this is the grassroots and the heart of the Republican Party. I mean, you of course followed Todd Akin in Missouri,
yes.
Right?
We got as much as probably other people outside of the state would get, but yeah, we're following that absolutely.
I mean, they
come back to the guy, right? It's like, you know, we want to condemn him and his bad remarks, poo, but you know, will we continue to shovel cash towards him if we think we've got a chance to win with him? Yeah, of course they will. Because they recognize, that, you know, that guy matters for them to win.
Well, when I was an undergrad, I was an intern in the Missouri State Legislature. I knew Todd Akin. He sponsored.
Oh, really?
He sponsored a weekly luncheon for interns. He was in the mainstream of the conservative caucus of the Republican Party in the state legislature. I mean, I knew him as well. The only person I knew better in the state legislature was the guy I interned for. I ended up writing something for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch about him. I mean, and what I find so humorous is that, you know, he's been around for nearly three decades in, you know, Missouri conservative politics. There was nothing that he said that everybody who knew anything about him knew he'd said this a million times before. You know, I mean, this was not some kind of guy who just ran for public office for the first time.
Right.
He was a mainstream Republican in the Republican Party. And, you know, and then people were shocked that I knew he was going to say something like that. I'd been telling my wife for months before that, like, he's going to say something crazy. I know this guy. And for the Republicans to be kind of surprised by that, I couldn't believe it.
I think that's a great story. I mean, I think that you saw that happening. I mean, Akin's not alone. Obviously, there were a lot of stories like that of just saying things that once they come out, you know, I think the conservatives have sometimes had this ability to speak this sort of secret language. They use a lot of code words, you know, and things like that, that I think makes sense to the people who are listening to them, who agree with them.
Yeah.
And then when they actually have to go for the general audience and they actually have to go for the entirety of the electorate, then suddenly you're face to face with, wow, this stuff is really, you know, this stuff really is, as strange as it sounds.
Yeah.
And I think I think what Nixon's a master at though is controlling that, right? I mean, he's really good at, right. I mean, he knows that he's got to placate. I mean, as much as he's going to, you know, take a hardline position on foreign policy issues, as much as he's going to sound at times kind of like a Joseph McCarthy, as much as he's going to do all those things, he still is able to placate the Deweys, the centrists, the moderates. That's the sort of master of politics that I think Nixon had. And I think it's missing from a lot of these other, you know, more contemporary conservatives, is that they can't kind of keep the cat in the bag. I mean, they don't know how to play it and then also reel it in when you need to reel it in. Nixon was able to do both of those things.
Yeah.
I think that's why he was so effective, was he could play every side of it and do it really well.
So we'll move the story along. I mean, so, you know, Nixon's secret slush fund is discovered, and so he has to give it, for some people who may not be totally familiar, Eisenhower is considering dropping him from the ticket. And what you're writing, and maybe I knew this, but I guess I forgot I knew this if I ever did, is that Nixon was told 2 hours before this national television broadcast he's going to give by Tom Dewey that Eisenhower wants him off the ticket. That Eisenhower wants him to use this television time to resign. Do you just want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, this is it's the one, when you have a story that's like this tense, and so, with all sorts of weird turns, you kind of, the narrative kind of writes itself.
Yeah.
And there's inside of it. This is one of these stories that's really, there's some really tense moments here. Yeah, so Dewey's always this guy who's kind of like, playing himself both sides of the aisle, and there's this tension that's always growing between Eisenhower and Nixon. Eisenhower didn't vet Nixon as much as I think he wanted to. I mean, we've heard that story that gets replicated with McCain Palin relationship. So he didn't really vet him, and then when this stuff starts to come, he gets really upset and worried. He also knows that to throw Nixon off the ticket would be very difficult to do. Eisenhower knows that that's a tough thing to do, and it would make him look bad. It would make Eisenhower look bad, right? Why'd you choose this guy in the first place? Maybe this is about your, political judgments in general. And so he's very well aware of that. But then, nonetheless, there's this conversation. It's never really clear if Dewey's like really delivering the message that Eisenhower wanted him to, or whether or not he's just kind of trying to, scare Nixon into doing something that Dewey himself wants him to do. It's never really clear, but he gets this news right as he's about to kind of embark for the television studio. And it just, it makes a guy who's hardwired, nervous, and really approaching a nervous breakdown and has nervous breakdowns up to the point in time, just puts him on that much more, of a plane of kind of almost existential nightmare. Mm-hmm. And then he goes in and he decides, I'm not going to resign. I'm going to turn this over to the American people. And he says, you tell me what you want me to do, and you tell the RNC what you want them to do. He kind of turns it around, and that's again where he's doing this brilliant thing of saying, I'm the populist in the room. I want the people to speak.
Yeah.
And he takes this event and makes it into this kind of, this sort of referendum on him, and whether or not people feel that they can trust him.
Yeah, no. And so this is almost kind of a moment where the right discovers unwittingly through Nixon, how do you battle the New Deal? How do you battle the popularity of all these social welfare programs? This sort of, as you talk about it, this populist authenticity that Nixon unconsciously kind of discovers as the sort of secret antidote for the conservatives to, make a comeback.
That's right. You cut out a little bit there, so I'm not sure. I might have not gotten everything you just said, but
would you want to explain
what you began with and what you ended with?
Do you want to explain populist authenticity?
Yeah, I mean, that's the central theme, I think, is that, how do you have a person who is taking money from industries that we wouldn't usually consider to be the love of populists, oil industry, real estate. These are the actual populists at the late 19th century, the people who actually organized something called the populists or the People's Party. These were their sworn enemies. These were the special interests that they wanted to drive out of politics. But now you got this guy who's caught with money coming from these types of folks.
Yeah.
He turns the populist thing into, can you believe me? Can I be an authentic person? Do I reach you? And this is one of the things that you get when you read the telegrams and letters that are sent to Nixon right after the speech that are in support of him. They almost always talk about, you reached my heart. Some of them are very emotional about, I cried when I heard about, your humble background. I felt connected to you. It's that sort of appeal that makes populism into kind of a style rather than the notion of the small guy who's upset with the powers of big business and the business interest. No longer that, it's about the style you project. And what I find to be really kind of ironic is that he seems to come off as an authentic person to this television audience. And you got to keep in mind, television's really new for Americans at this point in time. We're not the cynical, jaded people that we are today. So that's an important part of explaining how he's successful at this. But it's really amazing when you think about how Nixon is one of these people who wants to come off as authentic, and he's actually staging authenticity. I mean, he's giving the speech in a television studio on a set called the GI Bedroom Den set, where he's got these books that, you know, are on shelves, and he's sitting at a desk and his wife's sitting next to him at his side and all that sort of stuff. And you know, he's trying to say, I'm an ordinary average American. I'm going to line out for you what I own and show you that I'm just a humble average American. And project the sort of look of the sort of white collar, you know, kind of organization man that I think probably resonated in the 50s. And he's saying, you know, I'm authentic, believe in me, you can trust me, and yet the whole thing is staged. And I think it's one of the first discoveries that, you know, authenticity itself is something that can be staged. And I think we have that desire, right? We have this really weird expectation that a politician can be authentic and yet also be popular and influential.
Yeah.
And that's a real, I'm not sure if I can go so far as to say close to almost an impossibility, but it's a real challenge. And I think we now know that very often I think the person who probably came closest to doing this extraordinarily well in our contemporary times was George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Here's a guy, Ivy League, you know, tons of money, comes from a super wealthy family that we would associate with kind of East Coast elites, even though, you know, his background's in Texas in large part, and yet comes off and went to Yale and then just comes off as an ordinary guy and it stages himself as this authentic, ordinary guy. That's, I think, an amazing work of political genius. And I think Nixon gets it in 1952 kind of sets the template for a lot of people, you know, who follow in his shoes.
No, it's that's it. I mean, as usual, I mean, your books speak to very kind of contemporary issues. I mean, I really loved reading it. Just plain Dick. I have a typical last question, which is what's next? What are you working on now?
Oh, and I have a typical great answer. I have no idea. I don't have anything that I'm specifically working on right now. I've written a book that I'm happy with, and I'm not thinking about the next one. Not at this point. You might be able to call me in, you know, a few months and maybe I'll have a different answer for you. But, you know, I'm toying around with stuff, but nothing that's definitely congealed into something very definite.
All right. Well, anyway, I mean, you have a book out, it seems like every other year or maybe it's now every 3 years, but I'll look forward to the next one. Cause this is a great book put out by Bloomsbury. So Kevin Mattson, thank you for your time. Tell everyone to go out and buy the book and read it. Okay?
That's fantastic. It's been great to spend some time with you, Jeff.
Okay. Have a good afternoon, okay?
You too. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my interview with Kevin Mattson and talked about his book, Just Plain Dick, Richard Nixon's Checkers Speech in the Rocking Socking Election of 1952. Join me next week, and we'll be talking about another fine book on New Books in Politics.